Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Zachariah Hughes. Today we're talking about closing rural schools and what impacts that might have for communities and state budgets. Influential members of the legislature have started talking about possibly raising the state's minimum number of students that it takes to qualify for state education funding. Currently, that number is 10. 10 students to keep a school open. Though there's not yet a concrete proposal out, advocates say that with the state facing a dire revenue shortfall, the legislature needs to respond to how it pays for education. Critics say the change could close more than 60 schools in small communities, disproportionately hurting rural Alaskans for the sake of modest short-term savings. I'm lucky to be joined today by a crowded table full of guests. David Neese is a retired school teacher with the Anchorage School District and an education advocate who also served on the legislature's Sustainable Education Task Force. Angela Gonzalez is a graduate of Bettlesfield High School, which has since closed after dropping below that 10-student threshold, and has seen the impacts that it's had on the community since. She also runs a blog, the Athabaskan Woman blog. And finally, we're joined by Carrie Boyd, who is the superintendent of the Yukon-Koyukuk School District, which oversees 9 schools, most of them off the road system. And several of those would be closed if this proposal to raise the minimum enrollment number to about 20, that's the number I see cited the most often, were to go through. And Carrie, I want to start with you and just ask, what are some of the financial challenges to running the kind of schools that you oversee off the road system that make it so much more expensive?
Fuel and electricity. Some of our fuel has to be flown in. Getting the shipments out there for the curriculum, getting food out there for the food service programs. Everything is multiplied as far as if you live in Fairbanks or Anchorage School District. A flight out there is $500. A 1.5-hour flight. As far as running the schools, we have schools that were built for over 100 students, and now we have 30 students in them. And the enrollment is not enough to take care of the ever-increasing electricity and fuel costs that we still have.
We have a quote here from a group of rural legislators that published an editorial a short while ago. I want to pull it up. It says, "We've done our utmost to only support cutbacks that do as little harm as possible to essential programs and services that have as little adverse impact as possible on our economies and that do not create burdens that fall disproportionately on rural Alaskans." And what are the estimated savings that would supposedly justify such consequences? Less than $6 million using the current education funding formula. David, are the consequences of revising the formula, are they up to scale with some of the costs?
Well, the formula is in its fourth iteration. We've been revising it constantly. So they've tried to balance it because there's an equity that you have to pass with the federal government to make sure that you're funding all the education relatively equally. So somewhere that's rich, like Anchorage, has to take care of somewhere that's poor just to keep the balance in there. Other states have different approaches. So the amount that it'll affect is going to be determined by if they change the formula and how they implement it.
And can you just spell that out a little bit more? I mean, when you talk about...
I'll give you a good example. There are two good examples. Hawaii funds schools directly. It has a state board that runs it. There are no local school boards. They would give your school X amount of dollars per child. Wyoming does it where they have necessary small schools. So maybe they would say Bettles is a necessary small school, and they would fund it like at double the rate of an in-town logistical school. So those kind of conversations are probably going to come up. It's like, is this a necessary school? Does it produce what we want it to do? Because the state, ultimately, the legislature, has to fund schools. It has to fund programs of education, not necessarily schools. And that's the part that in the Moore decision you look at, it basically says they're responsible for giving every child an opportunity at an education. It doesn't say, and we will have a building for you to go to.
Right, and we'll get to the Moore decision a little bit later on and some of the counter proposals for if you know education doesn't look like this, then it looks like this. But before we do, I want to ask you, Angela, to just explain a little bit about what it was like after the school closed in Bettles. I don't know, I know you're not from there originally, but You know, in your time after the 90s, when the school closed, what happened to the town itself around that?
I think that when I was there, the population was around 50 people during the winter, and then maybe 100 with the seasonal tourism and like park service and stuff like that, activities in the summer mainly. And then now it's maybe the winter population is between 27 and 30, and in the summer it increases to 50. So it kind of like contributed to cutting the population in half, because there's not as many families there to have their kids in school. So I think it really had that kind of impact, and it just kind of rippled throughout the rest. And now it's many families have moved out, with kids, because they want their kids to have an education. And sometimes people don't have the wherewithal to, you know, teach their own kids, especially if they have a job or something like that. So.
And that raises something that was touched upon from an article this summer. And I want to pull up a quote from that. It was in the Alaska Dispatch News about the closing of the school in Cold Bay. And it was written, the closure of a village school in Alaska is not a new phenomenon. Every year, a few schools shut their doors due to a lack of enrollment. During the last state fiscal year, three schools closed, all in southeast Alaska. But being routine at a statewide level makes it no less wrenching at a local one. Losing the school can have a profound impact, drawing the very engines of the community, families with children, away, sometimes permanently. In regions already struggling with the difficult economics of life in rural Alaska, the closure of a school can feel like a death blow. David, I want to ask you about whether community health should be taken into account when the legislature is discussing education policy. Is it mixing issues to say, well, if you pull out of the community, you'll end up making an extra impact or an extra cost?
When we were on the task force, we were talking about the fact that you have ghost towns in Alaska, where the mining came and went, the trapping came and went. What you don't have a lot of is ghost schools. And we are slowly starting to see that process, in that you are having schools that are being closed because they don't hit minimum enrollment. But the conversation's always been the number. It's never been, was that school working? And I'd like to see the conversation be, was that school working? Was Bettles working? And if it is, we should be funding it. If it wasn't working, that should be part of the argument.
And Carrie, I'm curious to hear from you. I mean, is that what you're looking at? Do you agree with that, that kind of target goals more than target numbers should be the kind of the standard that's set?
That's kind of a unique question. It comes down to what defines what's working. If you ask me about my schools, I think they're all working. I think it serves a purpose to have the schools in there. I don't believe the number should go above 10. There's a gravity of effect that will have on the communities, on the students. I think there's a lot of things that haven't been taken into effect. The money that they may save, I don't think they have fully thought it out as far as special education services, bandwidth, if they have to build other schools, and the complexity of families that are unable to homeschool, where do you think they are going to end up in the long run?
And that starts to get into alternatives. You mentioned bandwidth specifically, and I know distance learning has been one of the terms that Representative Lynn Gaddis of Wasilla on the House Education Committee has brought up as a potential fill-in. You guys, actually, your school district does a lot with distance learning. I'm wondering if you can tell me what that looks like and whether you think that's a viable replacement for brick-and-mortar schools that are not actually made out of actual bricks and mortar, but even still.
I know what you mean. Well, with ours, the students that are on our schools in distance delivery, it's a choice. It's a choice. If we talk about putting that number up to 25, then it becomes a different choice. I just want to make that clear. But the way we have it, we have a certified teacher delivering instruction to the students at the various schools. And in the classroom, we have a facilitator. It could be a certified teacher, it could be a counselor, facilitator. So in order for it to be successful, you have to have that pieces together working simultaneously. It doesn't really work that well if you have students that are on their own.
I know.
And we have found that over the years.
Well, and I know from the perspective of Anchorage or the Rail Belt, Wi-Fi can look like internet access, broadband access can look like a great option, but I don't think that many people have seen the bills that districts like yours pay mm-hmm. broadband access. Can you just explain a little bit about that?
Well, we pay about we're subsidized, but it would be about $1.7 million, and we're maxed, and we were fortunate enough to receive that grant through the legislation to put us up to 10 megabits, I think 10 megabits. But even that, we are pinging, and what I mean by that is once we have our students on and we're doing our distance delivery, things become pixeled, it's not as clear, and we're maxed.
Angela, what was your education like? And when I ask that, I'm just curious if you think that going back, to the 90s when you were in school, whether you think that kind of digital curricula would have been a substitute or a replica for the kind of experience you had in high school?
Well, we had two teachers. George Nicholson was the principal teacher, and Miss Luck was the teacher. Mainly, she taught the high school students, which there were four of us at that time. I think that it's really having that person-to-person contact, I think, really makes a big difference. And I know, like many communities, weather is always a factor. So whether it's the telephone or internet connection, I think those really have an impact in travel. Those can affect, you know, whether or not I am able to get instructed that day or not.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is directly related to education policy at the legislative level, but I'm curious whether how socially it was going to a school that small, whether it felt intimate and like you were really connected, or whether there are times when it felt stifling and somewhat suffocating.
Well, I think it was, I basically grew up on the Keokuk River, and I really love going out on the land, and my dad had dogs over the years, so he was a dog musher, and just the rich lifestyle, I would say. I really loved it growing up, and it was a lot of fun. And then the school is like a community center. Sometimes the schools are like the biggest building in the community, and that's just where people, you know, gather for larger events. And so we all come together for not just school activities, but a lot of other activities, potlatches and stuff like that.
David, I'm curious, like how, because you've weighed in on this this decision from a legislative perspective and talking about what makes financial sense and how the formula should look, and I'm just curious how you take something like that into account when you guys are kind of hashing out figures and numbers and what's feasible.
Well, it comes back to what's working, and you can either look at it at a pure academic standards, which is that, you know, some of our schools are not working. You can have them right inside Anchorage. You can have some of our schools are not working, and some
are. When you say working or not working, what do you mean?
If you look at standardized testing, our fourth grade reading is 47th or 48th in the nation right now, which is, I think every kid should be literate both in reading and mathematics, and how that looks like is basically determined by what you use as a standard to measure. So nice to see the state picked a new standard to measure with, and we'll go from there. The key is, is your school a community function, and that's what you've built it for, or did you build your school to deliver education? The state's courts have basically told you that you're there to deliver education, and whether or not that impacts the community, well, if you don't have educated people in your community, you're going to have a problem. So you have to kind of look at it as a balancing act. I think there was an article in Wyoming. They have a lot of ranch schools. And there was two boys at one ranch. They had a small little portable school. They had a teacher that spent the 9 months out there with them. The state of Wyoming funds that because that ranch school's curriculum delivers what it wants, which is a high school educated kid that can go on to college if they choose to. Now that's a really good model. I don't care if the school's got one kid in it, or you're doing it by curriculum, or you're doing it by distance delivery. If it's working and you can prove that it's working academically, then the state has a vested interest in doing it. If it's not working academically, if you, one of the schools that you're looking at down in the southeast, there are four school districts on one island. We're funding districts. Now, I would rather fund the school than fund a district. If I can keep the school open and take all those administrators and consolidate it down to one, but when they did the budget study and the...
I want to pause. but I want to ask about Carrie. You work in a district. You work in the administration side. Mm-hmm. And why is it you know, why does there need to be an administrator for such small clusters of schools?
Oh, well, there is a lot of paperwork, and there is a lot of oversight and training and regulations and law that has to be accounted for. You have to have an administrator. We try to minimize it in our school district as the administration as much as we can. We have, for example, for four of our sites, we have an itinerant principal because we can't afford anymore to have its own principal when you only have a few.
And can I just want to interrupt because there might be people that are not used to the term itinerant principal.
Oh, okay.
And can you just explain what an itinerant is within a school district?
Sure. An itinerant, we have itinerant principals, we have itinerant counselors where they will travel from school to school to school to provide direct services when you can't have, for example, in our school district, we have three counselors. And we have 10 schools. So they share up the schools and deliver instruction and they travel through by air.
10 schools, I apologize, I think I said nine.
We call it nine river schools, and we have one statewide correspondence program.
Okay, all right, then I was
You're right.
How do you guys pay for stuff? And when I say that, I mean in a big way, particularly capital costs. I know we here in Anchorage just dealt with a school bond that went to the voters. It was about $60 million for eight school sites and renovations. What financing options are available to you guys for those necessary repairs? Like, what do you do if Allakaket needs a new roof or Hooslea needs a new heating system?
Well, we're pretty much at the mercy of the Department of Education, major maintenance, and new construction lists. We write grants. We write a lot of grants. And we wait for our turn to come up on that list. However, there are things that you can't wait for, so we will take operational funds to make those necessary repairs.
And David, is there a provision in the state's kind of education formula for that, for allocating money for upkeep to schools?
Yeah.
I know building schools was a controversial thing for a long time.
Rural education areas have, because of the Casilli lawsuit, they have a state mandated maintenance schedule. They have paperwork that's generated for the Department of Education. And that's one of the costs that you don't see in school budgets is like how much of your cost has to do the paperwork to get the money to get this boiler replaced out in this school. There is basically no property tax base to go off of. There's probably very little income tax base to go off of. So they're literally at the mercy of the state's funding. But capital is separate from operating. So when you go into operating and pay for capital, it's an issue.
And Angela, I'm curious how that looked from the perspective of being a student, from fundraising and stuff like that. Did you guys have money for teams to travel and for extracurricular programs, or was that something that was generated kind of internally through bake sales?
Well, we didn't really have sports. I mean, can you imagine, like, if there's only four kids, like, maybe skiing sometimes, but it was more temporary. But sometimes we traveled, like, to the district when they used to be in Nenana, and I was part of the Yukon-Koyukuk School District. And so we'd go for a couple weeks, and it was just, I guess, what was that exactly?
Oh, you're probably talking about the academies when you came into town for... We'd bring everyone in. It was before I was superintendent, but they would bring everyone in for these academies and for these exercises for students to have the opportunities. Some of the schools do have more sports than others and extracurricular.
Yeah, so we had, I think we called it print shop. And so we would get instruction that you wouldn't be able to get in the village. So we traveled for that, and sometimes there were, I think one year I participated in the close-up program where students went to D.C., and there was just a few from the whole district that went, so I'm not sure exactly how. I think the district helped pay for that, or I don't remember. Mm. But
I want to just take a step away from money and return to something, David, that you said earlier and push back just a little bit about outcomes, because I think very often it's framed as an issue of rural and bush schools are failing and rail belt schools are doing okay, or at least aspiring to being okay, depending on the standards. But I've heard from groups like SEAC, which is an education kind of advocacy group, that when you correct for low-income families, when you correct for a number of factors that are influencing students, that actually outcomes are quite similar in the bush and in schools in Anchorage, for example. And I'm curious whether a lot of this debate is about money or whether it's about design in terms of delivering services. And I wonder if you can summarize what the Moore decision kind of said on that topic.
The Moore decision, Judge Moore said there's plenty of money. That number one, we have plenty of money going into education. What we're not getting is outcomes that meet, satisfy the Constitution, which says that you are affording every child an opportunity at education. So the debate is always about money, but what the debate really needs to be about is, are you creating an educated workforce and students, are they doing well? Is her example coming out of Battlefield School? Is that a good example? Was it a good outcome? I think it is. She's doing really well for herself. And the opportunity of closing that school, maybe stopping some other kid from doing that, that's a terrible thing. But there is no proof that the Anchorage School District does any better with a poor rural child than a school sitting out in rural Alaska. We don't do any better with that bottom tier children. And I think that's where the focus of everything needs to be. You know, we do not have a definition of what an adequate education is in the state of Alaska. We don't have a definition of instruction. So until you have those two clarifiers of what it is as a basic education in the state of Alaska, we just removed the high school graduation test, we just removed the Iowa and the CAT. So we have the Alaska performance standards now. And I think that's where we're going to go. We have a good measuring stick, and you just have to go from there and decide how important it is to you and what your minimum standard is.
I am. Are you a proponent of raising the cap? Because that answer did not make it sound like this for you kind of hits the nail on the head.
This tool doesn't hit it on the head, because anytime you have a cliff, 10, 25, 100, Wyoming, it's 1,250 kids in a district. Then you have people that will move the pieces around. You'll recruit a teacher to move in with their three children so you can fund that school for another year. That's not a good way to approach the problem. The best way to approach the problem is, what is it we want our schools to deliver? And can that little school with six kids deliver it? If that little school with six kids can deliver it, we should be funding it full force. If that school with 350 kids in it can't deliver it, we should be looking at, what are we going to do to change that school? State has never stepped in and intervened.
Angela, do you feel like your school delivered?
Definitely. I mean, just the instruction from the teachers, I think they really prepared me for the world, I guess. And I went on to get a college degree and have been working ever since, so I really appreciated that education. I feel like I got a really good education.
What were some of the challenges to education? I mean, in your school in particular, there's challenges to every school and every community, but I'm curious what some of them.
Yeah, maybe not having sports. You know, I don't know, maybe I would have been more involved in sports if there was more opportunities. So that's definitely a challenge. And maybe just not having as many options, you know, for instructions. Maybe someone, like there's an algebra teacher sometimes, you know, and there's like seven, like my daughter goes to school here in Anchorage and she has like seven different instructors, you know, for her seven different classes. So I'm sure I missed out on some, but maybe it's compensated for having the closer one-on-one instruction.
Mm. And Carrie,
I think there's both, you know, both sides.
You said earlier that you thought your schools were delivering, were making good, and I'm curious what your yardstick is for that.
Well, if you're using the state standardized test, we have a school that missed being the five-star schools by 1 point. That would be closed. They are delivering. Our students they're graduating. They are successful. They are moving on. They are contributing members of society, and that's all we can ask for. That's what we want, to prepare our students for when they graduate from school.
What are some of the challenges that, from an administrative perspective, you see as taking, you know, say the biggest bite out of your ability to deliver positive educational outcomes?
I would say one of the biggest challenges is that our teachers have to prep for so many different courses. You hit it right on the head right there when you talked about in Anchorage, your child has seven different teachers. Some of our teachers have to teach math, English, science, social studies. And so for them to be proficient in every single one of those topics, it is challenging. But they do a good job. They have a smaller caseload, so they're able to provide a closer delivery of instruction.
We are getting to the end of our time, but I do want to ask really quickly whether any of you think this measure is likely to gain traction. And if not, you know, an official cap at 20 or 25, what you think the repercussions might be for kind of this being on the table at this point. David, do you have any?
Usually there's a a hold harmless clause in any legislation that comes out that gives you like 3 years to prepare. The 10 cutoff going to 25 without that would be a bad thing, because you have to give districts like hers a chance to adjust to the money that's going to either be lost or come in. So,
anyone else?
Are you asking if we think it would go through? Is that what you?
I would have rephrased it, but I think we're out of time. So I'll thank you for joining us. Thank you to all three of my guests, and thanks for being with us here on Alaska Edition. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.